crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal, and we're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. Well, as of today, nearly 100 biblical figures and dozens of biblical cities have been confirmed as historical through archaeological and historical research. The Israeli Antiquities Authority has over 100,000 artifacts that have been discovered in Israel since 1948, and they're available for your perusal on their database online, and countless more artifacts from ancient Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, and the ancient nations around Israel. They're all set up in museums around the world. Well, how familiar are you with these dramatic finds, these dramatic discoveries? We're living through this special time where the technological advancement in the field of archaeology and archaeological discovery has led to a virtual explosion of historical discoveries that are proving the reliability of the Bible as an accurate historical text. Yet this wave of archaeological discovery comes amidst about 30 years of work by a cabal of scholars in Israel and elsewhere who have sought to undermine the Bible as a historically accurate document. These scholars, some at the very forefront of archaeological and historical research in Israel, have taught the next generation of Israeli archaeologists and historians to have an unnecessary skepticism about the historical claims of the Bible. Dr. Walter C. Kaiser Jr., he addressed this growing bias against the historicity of the Bible in a foreword to the book, The Popular Handbook of Archaeology and the Bible, and that was published back in 2013. And this is what he writes, quote, "The case for the reliability of the persons and events of the Bible becomes more needed and more necessary each day as the newer generation's anti-biblical thesis takes a greater hold on the hearts and minds of its members," end quote. We really need more exposure of these biblically significant finds to counter the anti-biblical or anti-Bible hysteria that exists in the academia today, and specifically in the universities of the nation of Israel. Israel, the place that you would expect to be the bastion of biblical understanding and the beacon promoting the accuracy of biblical truth. And yet, it's not that way. Sadly, it's not that way in Israel. All the while, biblically significant and confirming artifacts are being unearthed today at a faster pace than at any time before in history. Continuing in his foreword by Dr. Walter C. Kaiser Jr., he writes this, "Meanwhile, the evidence for the truthfulness and the historicity of the Bible continues to mount up as never before. Just when skepticism seems to be making the most noise, we are being flooded with an overwhelming amount of real, hard evidences that demand a verdict opposite to what the skeptics, revisionists, minimalists, deconstructionists are clamoring for in their current worldviews and life views. Never has any previous generation seen the amount and significance of evidences that are now available to us today," end quote. And yet, I ask you, how familiar are you with these dramatic finds that have been discovered recently over the past 20, 30 years? Well, in part, it's not your fault. It's not your fault because in many instances you have been robbed by an academic world set on pushing its anti-Bible thesis, where many biblically significant discoveries are downplayed, minimalized, scorned, and subjected to a wave of undue criticism. The Bible is held by them to a far greater test and a far greater test of historicity than any other ancient document out there. Well, this program, Watch Jerusalem, as well as the website watchjerusalem.co.il, is going to try its best to set the record straight. We're going to trumpet the archaeological discoveries that are being made in the land of Israel, as well as bring into remembrance many that have been discovered in the 50 years before now that you might not have heard of. Along with that, we're going to look on this program at many of the current events paralleling this surge of biblical discovery and see how they too have biblical significance that is ignored by most, ignored really in a far greater way than the archaeological discoveries have been. Now, on today's first segment, we'll be talking about the hunt for more of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and along with that, some other ancient artifacts, ancient scrolls that have been recently discovered and deciphered from Israel. And following that, we'll be looking at the seemingly positive strategic position Israel now finds itself in and discover whether this wave of friendliness from around the world and other nations is destined to last. Welcome once again. You're listening to Watch Jerusalem. Welcome back to the show again. This is Watch Jerusalem, and I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. Well, discovered between 1946 and 1956, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're a collection of 972 ancient manuscripts. They contain parts of what is now known as the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh, as well as a range of extra-biblical documents. They were first found by a shepherd, Muhammad Ad-Jib, as he searched for one of his stray goats among the limestone cliffs there at Kirbet Qumran on the northwestern shores of the Dead Sea in what was then the British-mandated Palestine, now the West Bank, Israeli territory. And the story goes that in the cave, in the dark crevice of the steep, rocky hillside, Muhammad hurled a stone into the dark interior and was startled to hear the sound of breaking pots. Then, venturing inside, the young Bedouin found a mysterious collection of large clay jars, in some of which he found old scrolls, some wrapped in linen and blackened with age. Now, these texts are of great historical and religious significance and include the earliest known surviving copies of the biblical and extra-biblical documents, as well as preserving evidence for the diversity in the late Second Temple Judaism as well, the different strands to Judaism that existed at that time. These scrolls have been dated since their discovery to the various ranges between around 400 BC to about 318 AD. They're written in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Nabataean, mostly on parchment, but with some written on papyrus and some even written in bronze. Now, these scrolls are traditionally divided into three groups. The most important that we're interested in is the biblical manuscripts, which are copies from texts from the Hebrew Bible that comprise about 40% of the whole of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Among the scrolls are portions of every single biblical book except the book of Esther. It includes a full version of the book of Isaiah as well. So that's the brief history of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And over the past 60 years, they've been some of the most well-documented and most studied artifacts of the ancient world. Some call it the greatest find ever in biblical archaeology, and possibly that is true because of the way that they did confirm the accuracy of the Bible, the accuracy of the stories written therein. And, you know, until that time, the earliest manuscripts we had were from hundreds and hundreds of years after that. Yet we've got copies of the Bible, of the different books, at least from about 2,000 years ago. Well, right now in Israel, as announced this week, the search is underway to find more of these scrolls that could be located along the Dead Sea before looters and robbers find them. This is a report that came from the Associated Press. It's just this week. It's entitled, Israel is to begin an expedition to discover more Dead Sea Scrolls. And I'll quote here. It says, Israel is embarking on a major archaeological expedition to find yet undiscovered Dead Sea Scrolls, an Israeli antiquities official said Monday. Amir Ganor, the Israeli Antiquities Authority, said that a government research team will spend the next 3 years surveying hundreds of caves in the Judean desert near the Dead Sea, the arid region where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And this collection, the article goes on to write, is considered the crown jewel of Israeli antiquities. And you can see quite a lot of these at the Shrine of the Book at the Israeli Museum here in Jerusalem if you come visit. But really, this discovery or this search party, really, this expedition that's being put out to find some of these, more of these scrolls, is in relation and at motivation because of what the UN, the UNESCO, has been saying about Israel's right to Jerusalem, and even what the Palestinians are saying right now about their desire to take back the Dead Sea Scrolls, claiming that they belong to them. Well, now for the next 3 years, they're going to search out to see if there are any more of these scrolls. In 1993, there was a previous operation, it was called Operation Scroll, to find remaining Dead Sea Scrolls that had been hidden in the area of the West Bank before Israel transferred partial control of that area to the Palestinian Authority. And no scrolls were found in that undertaking. But since that time, there have been a number of scrolls that have been found in and around Qumran, in these the dry arid region there that creates a suitable environment that ancient papers, ancient documents can survive so long. And some of those were turned up because there was a robbery taking place in these caves to find ancient artifacts because they're so lucrative on the black market. And there have been, in recent years, ancient manuscripts that have trickled onto the local antiquities market, and looters are believed have plundered them, conducting their archaeological excavations, if you like, in the Dead Sea area to try and find these for profit. Well, the Israeli government has been prompted by that, and they are going to send out a search party to investigate these different caves, and there's many of them all through the western part of the Dead Sea to try and find some of more of these scrolls. Now, there was even the same day that famous UNESCO bill was passed that really did decide to not discuss or talk about Israel's historic claim to Jerusalem and the Old City. Instead, the UNESCO decided to use the Arab names, the Muslim names for those holy sites. The very same day that happened a couple of weeks ago, there was a dramatic discovery of a specific written document that was from the time of the First Temple period. Again, one that came from this area of the Dead Sea. Now, if you want to read more about the UNESCO vote and that from what UNESCO is trying to do in supporting Palestinian aims of really trying to stop and limit Israeli archaeology in East Jerusalem, you can go and read the article on watchjerusalem.co.il entitled UNESCO Wants to Stop Archaeology in Ancient Jerusalem. And you can find out about that. But we want to stick with this document because we're talking about the ancient scrolls of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other scrolls that they've found recently in that area. And this one, in many ways, predates some of those Dead Sea Scrolls. And it has some very important information on it. This is from the Israeli Antiquities Authority, their press release, again, released the same day as UNESCO vote. Quote, a rare and important find was exposed in an enforcement operation initiated by the Israeli Antiquities Unit, Israeli Antiquities Authority Unit for the Prevention of Antiquities Robbery, a document written on papyrus and dating to the time of the First Temple. This is the 7th century BC. So this is, you know, hundreds of years before the Dead Sea Scrolls. But what was written on this tiny little fragment? It was the name of the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Yerushalayim was written on this scroll from the 7th century during the time around Josiah's reign, King Josiah. And this is the earliest extra-biblical source to mention Jerusalem in Hebrew writing. This document, it was illicitly plundered from one of the Judean caves by a band of antiquities robbers and was seized in a complex operation by the IAA's Unit for the Prevention of Antiquities Robbery. And it was presented again that same day as the UNESCO vote. Here is the report from the Israeli Antiquities Authority. This is a clip. First up is Dr. Eitan Klein, Deputy Director of the IAA's Unit for the Prevention of Antiquities Robbery. And after that, you'll hear from an Israeli Prize winner and ancient writing expert, Shmuel Achituv. And this clip, again, I'll put it down in the program notes if you want to watch it for yourself later on. Take a listen.
We are talking about a document, a papyri, from the First Temple period, the 7th century BCE. This papyri is very important because this is the first time that we have shipment document or shipment certificate from this period, which specifying the place from where the shipment was sent from, Na'arata, place in Jericho Valley, the quantity and the content of the shipment, 2 jars of wine, and the place, the address from where the shipment was sent to, Jerusalem, the capital city of the Kingdom of Judea at that time.
Just a little note attached to 2 jars of wine that were sent from a place named Na'ara in the Jordan Valley, sent to Jerusalem by a lady. The significance of this papyrus, it's a small papyrus, a tiny papyrus of only two lines, but it is one of 3 papyri that we have from the period of the First Temple.
The Unit for the Prevention of Antiquities Looting seized the document during an operation that we made. It was a long operation. The operation was in the field, in the Judean desert, and also in the antiquities market. Eventually, we succeeded to seize the document and to bring it here to the laboratories and to save it, actually.
So thankfully, they were able to rescue that document. And just to recap now, the 2 lines of ancient Hebrew script that were preserved on the document that's made of papyrus do date it to the end of the First Temple period, the 7th century BC. They can tell that from the way that the letters are written and also a carbon 14 analysis of it as well. And the proposed reading is Me'amat HaMelech Me'na'arat Nevelim Yain Yerushalima, or from the king's maidservant, from Na'arat, jars of wine to Jerusalem. To Jerusalem, of all places, written in ancient Hebrew script. Now, according to Israel Hassan, director of the Israeli Antiquities Authority, this is what he said. The discovery of the papyrus shows that there are other artifacts of tremendous importance to our heritage that are waiting to be found in the Judean desert caves. The world's heritage assets are being plundered on a daily basis by antiquities robbers solely for greed. And again, if UNESCO wants to argue about something or wants to, you know, support something or get upset by something, that's what they should get upset by. The fact that antiquities robbers are stealing these artifacts on a daily basis. Then Israel Hassan, again, the director general of the director of the Israeli Antiquities Authority, continues, the state has to mobilize and allocate the necessary resources in order to embark upon a historic operation together with the public and carry out systematic excavations in all of the Judean desert caves. And that's, end quote, that's precisely what they're going to do. So remember, this was released the very same day that the UNESCO wrote a resolution that refused to mention Israel's attachment to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, preferring instead to only mention the Islamic attachment to that holy place. Well, here you have an artifact 1,400 years before Muhammad was even born, and it's written in ancient Hebrew, the ancient language of the Jews, and it features a shipment being sent to where? Jerusalem. To who? The king of Jerusalem. And you'd probably think he could speak and read Hebrew. Of course he could if he was to make any sense of this document. Now, the second artifact that was released a couple weeks earlier than that has a really interesting story as well. And Kieran Underwood, one of our writers for Watch Jerusalem, he wrote this up and it's on the website. It's entitled X-rays of a 1,700-year-old burnt scroll are identical to modern Bible. And this is what he writes. Around the end of the 6th century, in a town on the edge of the Dead Sea, a fire ravaged, this is the 6th century CE or AD, a fire ravaged the scrolls of a synagogue's holy ark. One of the burned scrolls sat for nearly 1,400 years before an archaeologist discovered it in 1970, but it could not be read. If it were opened, it would disintegrate. Then he writes, but with new digital analysis of X-ray scans, scientists have been able to virtually unwrap the scroll and read its contents. Without even opening this thing up, it looks like a charred cigar. They were able to read what it says. And if you want to check out how they did this, you're welcome to just click on the link in the show notes as well, and I'll have that there. There's about a 3-minute video just explaining how they went through this process. Again, another testament to how technology is actually helping the archaeological field and leading to the discovery of more biblically significant artifacts. Okay, so what did this scroll actually say? Well, it contained portions of chapters 1 and 2 of the biblical book of Leviticus, the third book of the Bible. Michael Segal, he's a professor of biblical studies at Hebrew University, who worked on the project, described what was written on the scroll this way. He said, "The text of the two chapters of Leviticus that have been found so far," so that there's actually more on this that's going to probably be difficult, more difficult to find, but they've found these two chapters so far, "is letter to letter identical to the Masoretic text that we know from medieval manuscripts. Similarly, in these two chapters, the section paragraph divisions are identical in identical locations to the medieval text or the Masoretic text." Now, we'll talk about what that means in a second here, but radiocarbon dates have dated the scroll to around 300 AD, but Dr. Adar Yedeni, after analyzing the handwriting of the text, dated it to earlier, probably around the 1st century AD. And the importance of this discovery really lies in the fact that it's identical to the Masoretic text. The Dead Sea scholar Emmanuel Tov, who participated in this project, said, "This is quote, this is quite amazing for us. In 2,000 years, this text has not changed." It hasn't changed. The Masoretic text that you, or the Hebrew Bible that you read today, is based on the Masoretic text from 1,000 years ago. And yet, it's based on something a lot earlier, and not just based on, but looks absolutely identical to something 1,000 years earlier. This Masoretic text is a Hebrew and Aramaic text of the Tanakh, or commonly known as the Old Testament, but the oldest copies of that actually date back to the 9th century AD. And it's interesting, when the King James scholars decided when he was going to put together the Christian Bible, he had to decide what he was going to use, or the people that worked for him were going to use, as the basis for the Old Testament text. What are they going to use? They had a number of choices. They could have used the Septuagint. They could have used the Latin versions. They could have used other documents. But they decided to go with what the Jews used, the Masoretic text. Even though it was from around 900,000 AD, there were earlier works of the Old Testament or the Tanakh, but they decided to go on those. And the English version in the English Bible is based off that text. Now, there was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, that was much older, dated back to 3rd to 1st century and a bit thereafter, BC. And the Masoretic text and the Septuagint, they differ in a number of places. And most of the differences are grammatical, but some involve additional verses and different words are chosen. And the King James Version, again, as I said, believe that it was more accurate to go and use the text that the Jews used, since that was the original language. The Hebrew was the original language it was given in, so it made sense to go directly from Hebrew into English rather than transfer it into a different language. Now, Segal, again, this person that from Hebrew University that was studying this document, said that the identical text in the scroll tells us that the medieval or Masoretic text is based upon a very careful transmission of an earlier text. And he says, "In deciphering the burnt scroll, scientists have pushed back the date of the earliest Masoretic text now by around 800 years. Now, this is super important, and it's hard, you know, even get caught up in the details here of Masoretic or Septuagint, what have you. But what it's saying is the version of the Old Testament that's commonly used today as the Jewish Bible, that's even commonly used in the English Bibles, of the Old Testament, is based on this Masoretic text, which is now proven to be accurate, more accurate than the Septuagint. And there are other English Bibles that have chosen to use the Septuagint Old Testament version, such as the Catholic Bible uses that. But now we've found that there's an even more accurate version of the Bible. Well, it's existed already, the Masoretic text, but now we know for sure. Now, how is this? Why is this important? Well, again, if we're going to say that the Bible is a historical document, and yet the Bible was written 2,000 years ago, how can we know that its transition or transmission from ancient times to now was done correctly? We need to know that the documents used to get to the Bible that we have today is actually accurate. And that's what this document really helps to show, that the Masoretic text of the Bible, the version that we have today, is much more accurate than the Septuagint version. It's even more accurate than the version given in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is most likely due to the fact of how they how the process of transmission worked of these texts, so that they would ensure that there would be no errors whatsoever. And this is what I'd like to quote from the text again, the Popular Handbook of Archaeology and the Bible. And it's telling us that the Hebrew text that we have today is right, is well done, and was copied in a superb way to ensure that there were no errors that crept into it. And this, of course, is what we've believed for so long, but we didn't have proof until we found a document such as this scroll of the first and second chapters of Leviticus that is written around the first century AD, and it looks exactly the same to the 9th century AD version. Again, I'd just like to quote here from this book to describe how this process worked, whereby they would ensure that there was no mistake in the copying of the text. It reads, "The Masoretes had as their primary concern the preservation of the sacred Hebrew Bible. Their attention to detail was remarkably evident within their work. They went to great lengths to develop the system of marginal notes with pronunciation marks and various instructions to make sure that the smallest detail of the text would not go unnoticed by the copying scribe. Every biblical book contained a colophon, that is, a scribe's notation of the details of his work, usually attached to the end of the manuscript, and a count of the total number of consonants. Moreover, scribal notes were taken identifying the middle letter of the book by location and stating the exact number of characters that preceded the letter and that followed after it." Then it continues later on. It says, "The final Masorah of the Second Rabbinic Bible also counts the number of letters, words, and verses found within the different books of the Bible. For example, at the end of the book of Genesis, the final Masorah states..." So this is a collection of the notes of the ancient scrolls. "Again, for example, at the end of the book of Genesis, the final Masorah states that there are a total of 1,534 verses in the book. And from the final Masorah, we also learn that the Torah contains 5,845 verses, 79,856 words, and 400,945 letters. It is the final Masorah that contains the information regarding the number of words in a book or section, the middle word of a book, and even the middle consonant of a book. For the Masoretes, the purpose of these statistics is to ensure the accuracy within the textual transmission process. If a scribe completed a copy of his manuscript and it could not be coordinated with the counts in the final Masorah, then he would know something was wrong in the transmission process and would therefore not transmit the text that was in error." Okay, so what did they do if they found an error? "When scribes made errors while copying a manuscript, or when errors were discovered in manuscripts," I'm continue quoting here, "they were immediately destroyed. Also, even when accurate manuscripts eventually began to deteriorate, leaving portions of the text tattered, they were also destroyed. This was for the purpose of preventing erroneous and partial manuscripts from circulating." So they had this really specific way of transcribing and transmitting one text to another, copying one text to another text, to ensure that they could keep on perpetuating the knowledge of this lore of the Bible without introducing their own errors into it, without introducing scribal errors. And if any way something didn't match up, sorry, we're going to throw it out and start it again. If it becomes tattered, if there's a couple of words we can't read at the end of a scroll, sorry, we're going to throw it out and start again. And because of this process and this attention to detail, we can say now that the Masoretic text, even though we don't have from, you know, around 100 AD from when this latest discovery was made of the first couple of chapters of Leviticus all the way through the 8th century, 9th century AD, we're missing 800 years of copies. We can tell that that one from 800 years earlier looks exactly the same as the one from 800 years later, the one that the Hebrew Bible is based off today. Now that's reaffirming. That is wonderful to know that the copy of the Hebrew Bible that we have is accurate, because then we can look into the history, we can look into the events of that Bible and then deem them as an accurate transmission of facts as well. Well, if you'd like to do some further reading about these discoveries, I'll leave a few links at the bottom of the show notes and you can click on them and read away. Well, when we come back, we're going to shift our focus from archaeology and discuss some of the growth in friendly relations that now exist between Israel and their nations around here in the Middle East. We'll be right back.
This is Trumpet Radio, 101.3, KPCG and KPCG.fm. The podcast of each show is available at thetrumpet.com, at KPCG.fm, and at iTunes.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace. And yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm, where history and prophecy come alive.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall, and we're coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel today. And for the second half of this program, I'd like to discuss in depth an article that came up on Mosaic Magazine just this past week online. It's entitled Everyone Loves Israel Until They Don't. And it's written by Robert Satloff. And I'd really like to encourage our listeners to go ahead and read that. I'll include it at the bottom of this program, a link to it so that you can read it yourself. It's really interesting because what it seeks to do is just put a dampener on the current thought in Israel and also across the world as far as Israel's relationship goes with a lot of the surrounding nations, that they are experiencing a renaissance in type, whereby a lot of the Arab Sunni states in the region are their friends, where you can, or at least having closer ties with Israel, and then you can even include the Russians in that as well, and even the Chinese, the Indians. There's been important meetings with all of those leaders and these other nations with Israel of late, and it's letting people wonder or making people ask the question whether Israel's standing in the world has improved Now, what we see often is just the opposite of that, with relationships between Israel and other nations suffering because of either the Palestinian issue or other things where Israel is targeted. Even we see that in bodies such as the UN. And yet of late, at least for the past 3 or 4 years, what we've seen is a closer relationship or a closening of ties between many states and Israel. But is that good? Will this last? And that's what Mr. Robert Satloff attempts to answer in this article. I'd just like to quote the very beginning of it now. It says, Israel is hot diplomatically, not just meteorologically. Old adversaries are burying the hatchet, new friendships are blossoming, and suitors around the world are jockeying for the attention of Israeli leaders, diplomats, generals, scholars, investors, consultants, and high-tech entrepreneurs. Now, it would be hard to believe that, it goes on to say, but just by looking at what normally gets reported in the American mass media, if you are an American, watching that, Israel is not painted in a positive light, and yet there are nations, businesses around the world lining up to do business with Israel. And then Mr. Satloff then continues. He says, at the risk of raining on a parade of what is, without doubt, good news for the Jewish state, saying that these relationships that are currently underway are better news than what it could be, or this is good news. I don't want to rain on that parade, he writes, and yet I believe a warning about, quote, irrational exuberance is in order. It's time to just take a check and see if we should be so happy or irrational about the relationship Israel is now garnering with the rest of the world. Then he says his purpose in this piece is to caution Israel and its friends against a series of what I believe are false hopes about the ultimate strategic significance of these welcome shifts, namely false hopes that Israel's current burst of geopolitical popularity will necessarily remain the, quote, new normal of international politics, that the world will forever agree to relegate the Palestinian issue to the diplomatic back burner, and perhaps the falsest of all, that one or a collective Israel's new friends could replace the often irksome, sometimes cranky alliance with the United States. That's what he's going to try and show. And he details through this article, in quite in depth, his different warnings of these different arenas. And the first one he covers is Israel's outreach to the Arab world and the closer relationships it has with the Arab world. And it is true. For the past couple of years, the Israeli foreign ministry, as well as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as he acts as foreign minister, deciding to take that portfolio himself in the Knesset, we have seen a strengthening and a closing of ties with the Arab states. And that was headed up by the former director general of Israel's foreign ministry, Dori Gold. He could be seen traveling to a lot of different Arab states, trying to conduct meetings with them or conducting meetings with them, taking businessmen with him. And this goes back to even relationships he was fostering with the Saudis almost a year and a half ago. And it kind of went from there. And to this point now where we have, even as he relates here in this article, a friend, an ally in Egypt's president, strongman president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and then also an ally, it seems, in the Saudis and the other Gulf states along with that, and then at least an alliance or strengthening alliance with Turkey as well to the north. Now, is this good? Are these alliances something that is going to last? Is this something that Israel can bank on going forward? I'd just like to quote one more section from this about these three nations. From this piece, it says, the long-term stability of any of these three realities is not a foregone conclusion. This isn't something that can go on forever, or it's not definite that it will go on forever, these closer ties with Egypt, Saudis, and Turkey. He writes, Egypt's volcanic domestic change has probably not seen its last tremor. And if you look at Egypt right now and just the poverty that is going across that nation, the rise of inflation, the shrinking of the Egyptian pound as well, food scarcities as well, subsidies being removed on goods. And the people in these situations tend to come up against their government and revolt. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing when they are going through these issues, but will the power that comes in control or that tries to lead these riots or tries to revolt against Sisi's government be better for Israel or worse? And all we need to do really is look back a few years to see what happened when Mubarak was put out of power, removed, or stepped down. And it wasn't a short time after that, but that Mohamed Morsi, the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, came into power and quickly tried to make Egypt into his own version, really, of the Islamic State, where Sharia law would rule entirely. And he was removed by Sisi, his general. And yet, how were relations going with Mohamed Morsi when he was in power, the Muslim Brotherhood? They were talking about marching on Jerusalem, how Jerusalem was the goal. And Egypt is nowhere near politically stable. It could return to that style of leadership real soon. Then if you look at the Saudis, the only reason that Saudi Arabia is having a closer relationship with Israel is a mutual animosity of Iran. Iran is seen as the greatest threat for both Saudi Arabia and Israel, and it is, when you consider their hunt and desire for nuclear weapons and where they would target those weapons, when you consider their terrorist activities and who they support around the world, whether it be Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which is a constant threat against Israel, of course supported and funded by Iran, or whether you look at Saudi Arabia and Iran's desire to motivate its Shiite proxies in Bahrain just off the coast of Saudi Arabia in the Persian Gulf, or even trying to destabilize things in Yemen towards Saudi Arabia's southern coast with via the Houthis, you know that Iran is trying to destabilize the monarchy inside Saudi Arabia. And that they're mobilizing their troops, the IRGC, as much as they can, and their supporters, to try and go against Saudi Arabian interests, be it in Lebanon as well, which looks like, for the time being in Lebanon, that Saudi interests have fallen flat to Iranian interests, or Iran, especially with the election recently of the president there, that was a Hezbollah-affiliated alliance. It looks like Iran has Lebanon right now. And then if you look at the state of the Syrian civil war, you have Iran again as using Bashar al-Assad, his proxy there, to fight against Saudi interests in the rebels. So you have Israel and Saudi Arabia right now with an enemy in Iran, and that is bringing them closer together. Now, will that last? Will that continue? If Iran wasn't a threat to Saudi Arabia, and that wasn't the number one priority in its geopolitical front, would it be such a friend of Israel? Well, Bible prophecy does show that at a time when Iran is taken out of the way, when the Iranian threat is removed, that Saudi Arabia will line up to be an adversary against Israel, will eventually even be part of an alliance to attack Israel. Okay, so then we've got that alliance that's very temporary between Israel and Saudi Arabia. What about this other one between Turkey and Israel? And I think it was last week, it named its ambassador to Turkey, and he's going to be shipped up there soon. Now, is that alliance between the Turks and Israel going to flourish under such a megalomaniac as Satlov calls him, in Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the leader there that's trying right now to change the constitution so that he can be elected for another 10 years till 2029 if he gets that constitutional change. He's not going away, and he's proven to be Israel's enemy. Yet right now, mutual interest might be that he would deem Israel a friend, maybe so that he can have access to Israelis' gas reserves in the Eastern Mediterranean. Maybe he's going to be a friend for a time. But what about when his needs are met? And what about if he finds another seller? Is he going to need Israel? Will he want a friendship with Israel? Will this be a long-standing alliance? These are all good questions, and one that need answering before Israelis jump up and down for joy at the current state of their diplomatic affairs and geostrategic standing in the Middle East. Now, some would say, well, that's fine if they're going to eventually turn from us. Right now, they're willing to be friends with us. So right now, we'll do business with them. And hey, that's good. That's understandable, that logic. But the danger is that it does send Israelis into a false sense of complacency that they are in a safer place right now in its standing in the world than it was 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, than the last Middle Eastern war. When really that's not true, or that could change virtually overnight. Surely there is somewhere else that Israel can put their trust. Now, is it in an alliance with Russia? Is it in an alliance with China, or even an alliance with India, those nations where we have seen a warming of ties? Mr. Satlov, he describes this thought or this warning. He states here, what then about Israel's non-Arab new friends, especially among the great powers of Russia, China, and India? It is, of course, no small achievement for Israel to have built such strong relationships over the past two decades with these powerful and influential countries, relationships from which Israel reaps enormous economic and, to a lesser but still significant degree, political and diplomatic benefit. Wise Israeli leaders will continue to do what they can to cultivate these connections. But, he writes, giddiness over Israel's new, quote, strategic partnerships, end quote, should be avoided. Then he says, two of these countries, Russia and China, are, to say the least, not democratic. Their relations with Israel are devoid of shared values and are based solely on assessments of current common interests. There are current interests for Russia or China to be allied or at least doing business with Israel. But they're just current. It's not based on shared interest or shared values, sorry. He continues, such assessments can change over time and overnight. Only one has to recall that in 1947, the Soviets supported the UN partition resolution that authorized Israel's creation only to shift course, arm Israel's sworn enemies, and eventually lead the fight for the UN's infamous Zionism is Racism resolution of 1975, a move designed to undermine the very legal and moral foundations of the Jewish state. If today's correlation of forces leads Moscow or Beijing to value relationships with powers other than Israel, there will be little nostalgia or sentimentality standing in the way of junking ties with Jerusalem. If there's a bitter offer, if it comes out that they can find a better deal elsewhere, there's nothing to hold Russia and China to Israel. Nothing. Nothing. So as he writes, is it good that Israel's reached out to these countries to try and do business with them? Sure, but that can change overnight as well. Then the other area that he talks about is the Palestinian issue right now, and the fact that it isn't such a big deal as far as the world is concerned, or as big of a deal as it has been previously through the 1990s and 2000s. Right now, the Arab world has a bigger fight on their hands. They have a bigger worry on their hands with the rise of the Islamic State and what's going on in Syria, Iraq, across northern Africa as well. This is what he writes. Next, an important component of Israel's current global success is the fact that countries around the world seem to have lost interest in the Palestinian issue. Given the dysfunction of the Palestinian Authority, the years of apparent fruitless diplomacy, the now structural division between the Palestinian-governed West Bank and Hamas-ruled Gaza, and most importantly, the far more pressing real-life urgency of the crisis in Syria and the twin challenges of Sunni jihadism and Iranian expansionism, it is no surprise that the Palestinian issue has been downgraded on both the regional and international fronts. Indeed, this change prioritization is both just and right. So yeah, there are bigger issues in the Middle East than just the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, and that's why it's not dominating headlines. Then it says, but we have seen this movie before, he writes. Remember 1987? That was the year when a previous episode of intra-Muslim sectarian conflict, the Iran-Iraq War, dominated Arab politics. That dominated Arab politics in 1987. Then briefly after that, the first Intifada. So this is something that can, the Palestinian issue can quickly come back to the forefront of politics, especially if something happens with the transition of leadership from the Palestinian Authority, from Mahmoud Abbas to the next leader, the chaos that ensues there, that could easily amount to the Palestinian issue becoming one that the world focuses on. And when that happens, world powers are forced to choose sides. And more often than not, they will choose the Palestinian issue. Okay, but what about the United States? The relationship that that Israel has right now with the United States, some would say it's obviously coming out of its one of its worst periods in history after 8 years of the leadership of America by President Barack Obama, who has a obvious disdain and hatred for Israel, and we're not going to go through all those points that reveal that, but partially is kind of symbolic when, as soon as Mr. Trump was elected, then Prime Minister Netanyahu came online immediately and recorded a message to him that called him his friend and that he was looking forward to working with him to strengthen the alliance. He said, God bless Israel, God bless America, and God bless our strategic alliance, I think he said, or enduring alliance. Now, will America's relationship with Israel improve under Mr. Trump? Now, he said that he wants it to improve, and I think Israelis generally believe that it will improve under a Republican president who are seen as being more favorable towards Israel and more understanding and sympathetic of their concerns and their difficulties in ruling over this territory. But will it improve? Even though President-elect Donald Trump says that he wants it to improve, that he wants to bring the embassy back there to Jerusalem instead of being in Tel Aviv, there are a number of promises that he's made that he just might not be able to keep. And while Mr. Satloff doesn't go into the conclusion to this point, he does say that this relationship that the United States has with Israel is something special. And it is something that this world really has not seen between a strong power and really a small power such as Israel before. And there's plenty of reasons for why this relationship and strategic alliance has existed. And we talk about that at watchjerusalem.co.il if you want to go there and read about that, of why it's so enduring. And yet, this alliance too is not going to succeed. And for that, we might not be able to go to current events or current analysis to just look at that in a purely physical point of view at the Israeli-American alliance. But we can go to the Bible and find out that this alliance, this brotherhood between Israel and America, is going to fail. Eventually, it might see a resurgence here under Mr. Trump. But the end of that alliance is definitely clear. And I would like to encourage you to really head to watchjerusalem.co.il and read, click on the prophecy tab there. It's a really important section we've dedicated some time to on the website to explain point by point, prophecy by prophecy, what is going to happen and already is happening in the Middle East concerning Israel and the other Middle Eastern nations around it. And we've tried to put them in order as well of when they should be fulfilled. And we haven't overwhelmed you with a lot of text, but there are booklets that you can request even on that same website for free anywhere around the world. Anywhere in the world you live, you can get it to prove it to yourself that these prophecies are coming true, have been coming true, and will be coming true. We talked about at the beginning of this program how the archaeological discoveries are confirming the biblical record, the historic record of the Bible to a degree that they never have before. We are living in the age of scientific discovery, which has the means to unwrap or read scrolls that are burnt from 1700 years ago without even unwrapping them. And all this advancement in technology, while it hasn't changed mankind's nature or attitude or the way we treat each other, it has changed science. And it has given us the ability to uncover history or rediscover history. And the history that we find in Israel, as we covered in the start of this program, confirms the biblical text. Now, if those archaeological discoveries confirm the biblical text, confirm those events that took place in the Bible as being accurate and true, shouldn't we give more credence to also the other things written in the Bible? The third of it, that is actually prophecy for our time right now. And if you doubt that, again, go to the prophecy page and watch Jerusalem. Read those prophecies. Look at those scriptures, those portions of scripture that are being proven to be accurate, at least in the time that they were written, and describing accurate historical events. Will they describe accurate events for the future? Well, of course they do, and especially for Israel. Is Israel in a safe position geopolitically? Well, Bible prophecy says that it cannot rely on or hang hope on temporary alliances with enemies, or even hope in a strengthening reliance with the United States under a Trump administration. Of course, there are places, though, that Israel can put its hope and its trust. We're coming now to the end of our first show from Jerusalem, Israel. Please, again, check out the website, watchjerusalem.co.il. There you can also find a more in-depth explanation of some of these prophecies and request or download those booklets free of charge sent to you anywhere in the world. And if you have any feedback on the show or the website, please feel free to email letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Again, this was Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.